cannot sacrifice proper Torah behavior for lackadaisical behavior. All right, first of all, today is October 20th, 2014, and at this moment in time, the Kollel is starting up again after the long interlude for Yom Narayim and Sukkot. And as I said last night, I'm probably the only Jew walking around who is sad to see Pesach leave, Sukkot leave. I would prefer to have Pesach 6 months a year, Sukkot 6 months a year, for Shalom al Yisrael. The news of the last week has been devastating. The Chilul Hashem is beyond comprehension. I ate with both Leil Simchas Torah and Leil Shabbat. I ate the Sudah in the company of colleagues of mine, among them Lamdanim of Hakam Yireim Vishleimim, and as a colleague of mine put it, I can tell you who, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Waxman, if the name means anything to you, that's Rabbi David Lifshitz's youngest son-in-law, and I know Chaim many, many decades, and Chaim said, if we read in the novel about what this rabbi did, we wouldn't believe it. We would say the person who wrote the novel is off the wall. It is impossible to have such behavior. And it's very depressing because one scandal follows another scandal, and each scandal, it's across the board. It's every type of Jew you can imagine, Haredi, Hasidic, Litvish, modern Orthodox. It's just beyond comprehension. It's very depressing. And, you know, to me in particular, this scandal hits home. It's right in our blood and flesh. This is YU, this is RCA, this is someone that I heard. I don't know him personally. I know him from the Vikings, from afar. But everyone's would tell me over the years he's reliable, you can depend upon him, a good reputation. When the documentary on the Rev, which I brought into the world, was shown in Baltimore, I was told now that he was the one who introduced it. So God have mercy on us. So I just want to say a brief thought that gave me succor and comfort. And it's a sad thought, but you can't explain it. Interestingly enough, Rabbi David Miller this morning paraphrased what I said independently of me, of what I said. We both said exactly the same thing. You read Parshat Bereishit. So you know, how many times have we studied Parshat Bereishit? I've studied it, I would say, 70 times already, my age, Yeshiva Ketana, and the Parshat Bereishit, and Mefarshim, and the Rav. And I remember the Rav saying to us, I forget whether it was at an RCA convention or whether it was a YU rabbinic alumni, the Rav saying to us that as much as he studied Parshat Bereishit, he still finds new material, new insight each time he reads it. And when I thought about Parshat Bereishit, I thought of the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot HaKavod, seeking covet, jealous of others, lustful desires. And you know something? Nothing has changed. When you look at Parshat Bereishit, you can find in the Parsha stories about covet, about kina, about tava, about the human being. And it's as if we can use the word the Rav taught me, ontological. Ontological. It's part of creation. And in Parshat Noach, you have an unbelievable sentence, Ki yetzer lev adam ra min rav. So all I can say, maybe we shouldn't be upset. This is par and parcel for the course of life. Lo aleinu, you're going to have people who will sacrifice everything for Abisul Kavod, for jealousy, for taiva, and Chilul Hashem, and nothing is meaningful to them outside of ultimately fulfilling these desires. And here's where you need the Musa movement, and this is why I cry, I sigh. The Musa movement, which I grew up on, I lived it, I took it seriously. It shaped my life, it shaped my personality, it shaped my thinking. It shaped every decision I had to make in my life. My life is an open book. And you know what I've said time and again, the Hasidic movement affected millions upon millions. My own grandson went to Uman for Rosh Hashanah. And worse than going, as a Litvak, he enjoyed it. He came back and gave me a detailed report of how much, and he's going to go next year. It's going to cost me more money. I'll give him, this year I gave him $50. And next year, Be'ezrat Hashem, Belined, I'll give him $100. I want him to go and enjoy and have money. When I was in Russia working for the Mossad, the $100 could buy you half the country. I don't know if they can do it today, but nevertheless. But wow, $100, 1980s. Am I right or wrong? What do you say? What do you say, Yoma? Baruch Hashem. So I want to tell you, when I thought of Parshat Bereishit, that this is a mensch, this is a man. We try to rise above it, but very few succeed. Musa affected hundreds since the movement began, approximately 1840. Hasidus has affected, I would say, tens of millions since the Muslim movement began, because its demands are different. Its demands are much lighter. You can be a simple Hasid going to a Fabrengen, but to be a Muslimic, it's not simple. You have to be an Iska Abba Mensch. If anyone can translate that into English, I'll give him a gift. Okay, secondly, I want to present the gift to Yomo. I have to tell you about Yomo. I gave a lecture last night at the OU, and I was very upset. It started to rain. I'm an older person. I don't have to go around lecturing and building a reputation. All right, Rafi Hakatan, as we have agreed to name him, will handle it. But all right, I made a commitment. I have to show. It's pouring rain. All right, Baruch Hashem, there was a nice crowd there. But Yomo was the only one, came from the Kollel, came with one mission in mind, to record the lecture, Lezakot et HaRabim. And I have to tell you, it's already online. People ran after him after the lecture. He could give you the story. They wanted to know when they can, it'll be online, when they can hear it again. And I want to thank Yomo to my dear student, Rabbi Yomo, in quotes, Gachman, his real name is Yosef Mordechai Shmuel Tzivagola, with all good wishes, the temple of success and spiritual greatness, Aaron Rakefit, Poi HaKodesh Yerushalayim, Ishru Chag Sukkot Tashat. Not exactly, but more or less Ishru Chag. Larry, pass that on. Okay, now, with all that said and done, down to work. We're in the middle of talking about Rav Shmuel Belkin, a name that is Friday night, Dafkar, and the company I was a lot of YU bigwigs. And we were talking about Rav Shmuel Belkin, and each one was adding another story about Rabbi Belkin. Last night, the girl who ran the OU, not the girl, one of the people who came to the session at the OU to my talk. So after the talk, she told me how she was a shit-ingle for YU, a kid of 18, between high school and college, some sort of program with a scholarship, and she had to work in YU a few days a week, and she was basically running back and forth between the offices, delivering, was before emails, before fax machines, and she was delivering letters, memorandums, and many a time she had to go from the yeshiva to Rabbi Belkin's home on the west side. And she described to me, here she is, an 18-year-old girl, nobody but nobody. And her Rav Shmuel would open the door for her and take her coat, escort her to the elevator. And she said he treated me like I was a princess. And this was the personality. But again, I want to repeat, he was caught between two worlds. There's no question about it. When we look back now to the big campaign, we spoke about this in great depth, the election and the candidates. Imagine had the Rav been elected. It would have been a tragedy. We probably would not be sitting here. You follow me? Had the Rav been elected, we probably, Shmuley, would not be sitting here. But thank God the Rav wasn't elected, Rabbi Belkin was elected. And for Rabbi Belkin, as you saw from that letter, Dear Rebbe, how it became, to a certain degree, a semi-tragedy. He had to give up teaching, he had to give up the classroom, he had to give up his Litvisha learning, and he becomes the president of Yeshiva University. And here's a man who could barely speak, he couldn't speak Yiddish, Kami wasn't an orator, not in Yiddish, his native language, certainly not in English. He spoke as if there were marbles in his mouth. But the man moved mountains. He was, nothing could budge him, a man of steel and a certain charm. It was an amazing individual. And his vision, as we saw last week or last time we met, was not much different than the Rav. As far as their vision of yeshiva, what yeshiva should be, what yeshiva should become, it was not much different than the Rav. And he viewed Litvisha learning, that was the way to go to in America, that was the way to go in the New World, everything I spoke about last night, rupture and reconstruction. He viewed Litvisha learning as the reconstruction of the Torah world after the Holocaust. Concomitantly, simultaneously, we're in the great Western world, we owe America a vote of thanks, we have to build institutions. And I told you the story last week with Jacob Hartstein, and I heard it from Jacob Hartstein with these ears, how the Rav and Jacob Hartstein was then what we would call today the dean of the college. He was called the registrar, but he ran the college. And Jacob Hartstein, they meet the Rav outside the Beis Medrash, and they ask the Rav, now that you've been elected, what are your plans? And the Rav starts telling them university status and graduate schools. And the Rav and Jacob Hartstein walk away laughing. What is this man off the wall? He's going to achieve this. And as Jacob Hartstein told me, within a few years, they were laughing at themselves for doubting Reb Shmuel Belkin. And YU status, university 45, graduate schools that we'll talk about, and this man builds, expands the yeshiva, places it on the map. Now, yes, Mori.
What would have happened to Rabbi Belkin if he had not become president?
Rabbi Belkin had not become president, we might have had two people on the Rav's level in the yeshiva. Exactly. And the difference would have been that Rav Shmuel Belkin would have been much more approachable than the Rav was in the 40s into the 50s. Okay? That's exactly so important to understand, that ultimately the Rav and Rav Shmuel Belkin supplemented each other. It until the early 70s, it was a perfect marriage. Two individuals, each one supplementing and complementing. The vision was essentially the same. My own humble opinion is, having known the Rav and Rav Shmuel Belkin intimately, Rav Shmuel Belkin, you felt there was more of a divide. In other words, he could be the, and I'll get to this, not today, he could be a Litvisha Rosh Yeshiva, Litvisha Lamden, and a few hours later, you'd meet him again, president of Yeshiva University, dealing with Albert Einstein. There was more of a divide. With the Rav, I always felt he was more kulo, the Litvisha Rosh Yeshiva, and he brought the Western world into his Litvisha Welt. You didn't feel the divide that you felt with Rav Shmuel Belkin. That was my own take. I may be right, I may be wrong, but there's no question what I ended off last week's shiur with, and I'm going to continue and go into more detail, there is no question that the Rav was upset when he wasn't elected. The Rav was a human being. HaKavod v'Akina v'Ataiva, Misha Gadol Mechavero, Yitzra Gadol Mechavero. I don't understand that Maimon Chazal. I will admit that's the only Maimon Chazal that I do not understand. I'm learning from Shas al HaSeder a third time, but that Maimon Chazal I do not comprehend, but that's my problem. But the Rav was a human being. And when Rav Shmuel Belkin was elected, he felt bad. He lost out. And I absolutely stand on what I'm saying. I don't accept Ann Gerber didn't know the Rav as intimately as Shulamit Meiselman. And I've spoken about this with Shulamit Meiselman, with Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. And I've done my research. And I've spoken about this with leaders of the community in Boston, the 30s, the 40s. And the Rav was very upset at Kashrut scandal. What the heck do I need Boston for? And what do I need my you for, just to be another Rebbe among them? Remember, the Rebbe wasn't the Rebbe yet. I don't want to use the words. I'm a Talmud. I'm not allowed to use the way they refer to the Rebbe. The way they refer to the Rebbe in Lakewood today, with his initials, is the way they refer to the Rebbe in what is YU today. So Chicago offered him that position. You know, you have to think, what would have happened to Chicago, which has really never found itself until today? Skokie is searching for its proper, total, complete, harmonious identity. You think, like you asked, what would have been if? If is the biggest word in the dictionary. If the Rav had gone to Chicago, but you see, the students protested. He had his Talmidim. Rav Shmuel Belkin told him, you remain here. I'm going to worry about money. I'm going to worry about finances. You devote yourself to your students. The Boston community pleaded with him not to leave. By that time, Maimonides was on the map. It was an institution. He had followers in Boston. There started to be Shmirat Shabbat in Boston. Everyone pleaded with him not to leave. It was a difficult decision. What can I tell you? But he evidently, see, in 35, when he went to Israel to stand for the chief rabbi, went to Palestine to stand for the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, there is no question he had not yet found his home yet. He was not at ease. He was willing to leave Boston. He was willing to go to Tel Aviv. He was willing to be a chalutz. Remember, this is a man who came from Vilna to America. He could have, halavai, he had got, remember we spoke about it, it's not that I don't want to repeat myself, the Vilna rabbinate, and he didn't get it, and he's leaving Europe, bal kocho. It's not that he wanted so much to leave Europe. And he comes and he's willing to go to Tel Aviv, but by 44, there were factors that made him make the decision to remain in New York. And the relationship between the Rav and Rav Shmuel Belkin becomes critical. Now, before I go further, I want to just make one other comment and show you the difficulty in trying to establish Rabbi Belkin's life. And halavai, the person who will do a doctorate about Rav Shmuel Belkin will be able to come to a conclusion. What I have in front of me is a Xerox copy of a little booklet that was issued, the inauguration of Samuel Belkin as the president of Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary and Yeshiva College, May 23rd, 1944. Now, this was a tremendous event. If you see May 23rd, you're talking about the heart of World War II. You're talking about before the invasion of Normandy and all that's going to happen. And this event had high press coverage. Yeshiva University, there are so many greenhorns in America now, so many immigrants. Orthodoxy is no longer a minority of a minority. It's a minority, but it's not what it used to be. It's larger, it's a little bit more vociferous and vocal. And they give you a biographical sketch of Rav Shmuel Belkin. So look what it tells you. At the age of 11, he left for the yeshiva at Slonim. Subsequently, he studied at the yeshiva of Rotten and Mir. What a Mir? As far as I know, Rabbi Belkin never set foot in there. And this is an official publication. Did they do their research? Did they ask him? Where did they get the information? Rotten? Yes. He studied for a brief time at Rotten. Now, if you say Slonim, how does he get to know Rav Shimon Shkup? Doesn't all the material we have indicate that the Rav Shmuel Belkin and Rav Shimon Shkup knew each other yet from Europe? Rav Shimon Shkup was in Grodno. He was not in Slonim. So you see, right here, you have a problem. Who is correct? There's valuable information in this article. Dr. Belkin married the former Selma Ehrlich, daughter of Hyman and the late Lena Leventhal Ehrlich, and above all, as I told you, my granddaughter of Rabbi B.L. Leventhal, that's Dov Aryeh, Bernard I don't know what the L stands for in English, but in Hebrew, Dov Aryeh HaKolchem Leventhal, Dean of the American Rabbinate. He has two children, a daughter, Linda Rose, born on November 26, 1937, and a son, Salo Maurice, born on August 19, 1943. Now, the daughter, the descendants we have today from Dr. Belkin are all from his daughter, Linda. She married Ralph Schuchalter, and she had children with Ralph Schuchalter. They later divorced, and she marries again, a father of Talmidim that I taught, but they later divorced too, and there are no children. But from the Schuchalter family, Chanai and Hara, their grandchildren, great-grandchildren, Baruch Hashem, Kulam Oskim B'Torah V'Mitzvah, part of the family living in Yerushalayim. The son, I don't know the exact story, but again, I'm probably one of the few people alive in the world who actually met the son. And how did I meet the son? In my first rabbinate in 1961, my congregation, the Sisterhood, Lower Merion Synagogue, did a chesed party for Jewish children in a home for children of special needs that was across the bridge from that was in Camden or Cherry Hill in that area in New Jersey. And I went with the Sisterhood. We made a party for these children, and a young man comes over to me, and at the time, you can make the cheshbon when he was born till 60. He was appeared like a child of 8, 9, but he was much older. And he said to me, "Are you from Yeshiva University? Maybe you know my father." And the kid tells me who his father was, and I knew that there was a child. How, here there's a machlekes hapaiskim. I've tried to research it. I always believed he was born challenged. Someone fairly reliable told me he was injured in an automobile accident. I don't know what the truth is. But obviously this boy died at a young age, never married, there are no children. So what survives from Dr. Belkin is from his daughter, Linda Belkin Schuchalter, who's exactly my age today. Yeah, yes.
Did he have a second wife as well?
Yeah, he married later, he divorced. We'll mention it at the end. Abby, she just died in May. Abby just died this past May. I think she was over 100 years old or close to 100. Dr. Belkin paid a very heavy price, as we will see later in life, for the success of yeshiva, but the pressures, the financial pressures running the yeshiva were overwhelming. And when we knew Rev. Shmuel Belkin, any student from the 60s into the 70s, I already lived in Israel, I already had graduated, so I got smicha 61, but any student from that period who knew with Ben Schoenbel that the Rav didn't become president of Yeshiva University. You follow me, Shmuley? It's plain and simple. Now, I just want to cite one more document, a fascinating document, before I introduce my special guest. And as I said, Rav Shmuel Belkin, he remained the Litvische Talmud of the Chafetz Chaim's yeshiva. He was a Talmud of Rav Mendel Zaks, the Chafetz Chaim's son-in-law, who I mentioned last night in the lecture. And concomitantly, he was the president of Yeshiva University. So here I have a very interesting communication with someone known as Aryeh Gordon. Now, Aryeh Gordon is a grandson of Rabbi Raubach. If you recall my lectures last year or 2 years ago, I forget already when we hit it, in 1919 the yeshiva graduated, the reorganized, revamped Rabbi Isaac Elkanah Theological Seminary graduated its first class, Shmusmachim, who studied and learned Yeredeya al Admat, the United States. One of the first 5 graduates was even an American-born individual born in Pittsburgh, Saul B. Friedman. If any of you from Washington Heights, your grandparents will tell you who he was. He was the rabbi of the young Israel of Washington Heights, and he was a lawyer, and he was a Talmud Chacham, and he was one of the first 5. It was overwhelming, an American-born individual. who studied and getting smicha, and among the five was a Rabbi Ralbag. I believe that family originates from Yerushalayim, if I'm not mistaken. Gordon, Aryeh Gordon is a grandson. I can tell it to you a little bit differently. Aryeh Gordon's sister is married to Nat Lewin. All of you have heard of the famous lawyer Nat Lewin. Nat Lewin, this is his brother-in-law. Now, he wrote to me, and he listens to the Shiurim, so he wrote to me, he describes his family, and he describes, I was a student in YU in the early 1970s. Our shul, that's his father's shul, okay? His father was part of a group of Americans that went to learn in Mir and Kamenetz in Poland. Coming back to America, became a Magid Shir in Chaim Berlin, a Rav in Brooklyn, and later he became a Rav on the West 73rd Street in Manhattan. When Rabbi Dr. Belkin moved to the West Side, everyone was wondering, which shul will he go to? Rabbi Lam at 86th Street, Rabbi Riskin at Lincoln Square. And he describes the shul, our shul, the miniature shul. Not a shtibu with tables and chairs, but it's a small shul. It's located in a townhouse on West 73rd Street on the second level. You walked up the outside stairs and down a hallway into the shul. I sat with a view of the hallway and would see people coming in. One Shabbos, shortly after his move to the West Side, I saw him coming down the hallway. Dr. Belkin had that way of walking, a kind of sauntering from side to side. I could not tell who it was at first, because the light was behind him, which obscured his face. However, that distinct walk gave him away, and I knew from the distance that it was he. Dr. Belkin walked in. My father greeted him and gave him a seat next to him. And until his death, he stayed in our shul, developing a warm friendship with my father. So you see, that's also an interesting comment, that where did the Shmuel Belkin daven? Not in the big shuls, not in the shuls that the atmosphere was totally modern orthodoxy in the United States, but a semi-shtibel where the Rav was a Rebbe in Metifta Chaim Berlin in Brooklyn. So it's a fascinating comment, but once again, you get the feeling, you get the image, Rav Shmuel Belkin, rupture and reconstruction, everything I spoke about last night. Two worlds lived within one man. One moment, the Litvisha Talmud of Rotten. And another moment, the president of Yeshiva University corresponding and speaking with Einstein and getting him to lend his name to the medical school. You have no idea what an achievement that was. With that being said, I have a little surprise for you. First of all, let me just see that I know the names. Yomar. Now, Max Daniels is not here. What's the story? Is he studying with me, not studying with me? Who is friendly with Max Daniels?
I'll speak with him.
You'll speak with him? You tell him I expect a bottle of John Daniels for the class to celebrate when he returns, okay? If he can't handle it, take up a collection. The New York Times just had a major article in the magazine this past Sunday. The Beggars of Lakewood. Read the article. And I just wrote a letter to a very important rabbi this morning. I just left Sherry an email. The problem is that in Lakewood, they're probably proud of that article. That's what bothers me more than the article. Okay, Jason Allen, right there. Rafi Hakatan, I loved your answer. Tell your wife to be, I was impressed. You remember what you told me, or do I have to remind you? Okay, I love it. Where is Alex Glassman? Oh boy, don't tell me the glass broke in the house. Who knows Alex Glassman? Who told God? You guys don't talk to each other. Yomo, send him my regards, okay? Tell him I was looking for him. Mark and Oral K, Alan, Moshe Schwartz. Happy to see you back, Moshe. Is that your pen that was left there on the table? Do you see?
I got it from the pendulum.
Put it back.
I made it.
You made the pen?
I made the pendulum.
You made the, so put it back. I see it there. I wrote it to see if it writes. I was going to throw it away, but I see it writes, and I figured it has to be yours. You were the only one here, working here when everyone was gone. Okay, Morty, Vic, Yitz, probably recuperating from last night, and Shmuley. Gentlemen, in life you meet wonderful people. Stress the good people you meet, as I've told you more than once, and it's very hard for me to say this because you have no idea. That, I mean, I don't want to record. I don't want it to leave my lips to take Taret Mishpacha. Do you have any idea what we're talking about? And if the police are telling the truth, what they found, are you in the shir or are you a guest?
Eli Shastak, I just came to the
Kollel.
My wife and I had a baby, so we
came. You're in the Kollel? You're willing to study with a guy named Rakefet?
So I'm trying it out.
Trying it out. Poseidon, you let me know if you're staying. Eli, you and I have a score to settle. I've just been speaking 40 minutes on Rav Shmuel Belkin, and you're coming in with your coffee. You should daven at 6 in the morning and get the shir on time. I read Steve Riskin starts his day at 4:30. I'm not the only one who starts his day. Today I started 4:22, actually. Oh, my. Anyway, you meet a lot of good people in life. If you meet one or two good rabbeim, you have it made. You have good friends, good people you saw. There's a gentleman sitting here who is 1 year behind me in yeshiva. We know each other a lot longer than most of you have been alive, even twice as long as you've been alive. He not only is a great guy, a graduate of Yeshiva College 1 year after me, a degree in law from Harvard University, but he also married a fabulous girl. If you recall, we said that Dr. Belkin used to spend time at the Bat family, right or wrong, in New Haven, Connecticut.
He had a relationship with Yale.
So he married a Bat, okay, Miriam. A daughter, his brother, who was a good friend of mine, Lola Leno, and died. Well, he made it to 70, right?
But
74. But yeah, but that's young today. I'm looking down, 74, what? That's a kid today. She had to know her brother, too. If you wanted to meet Sadikim, Aaron Bat, Miriam Bat, there must be other children, but I knew those two.
Norman Katz.
Norman Katz, it's also brother-in-law. Married. Brother-in-law married to a Dershowitz.
Married to Judy Katz.
Judy Katz. Right, she married to Judy Batt, and his sister married Sam Dershowitz.
Right.
Anyway, Larry was listening to the Sherman, Reb Shmuel Belkin, and he called me and started to tell me about his relationship with Rabbi Belkin. And I said, let the class hear this. Let the thousands that are listening across the world hear it. So pull over a chair and tell the class. Shimshon Halperin today. He doesn't go with Larry. He goes with Shimshon.
I'll continue. Aaron, I knew him as Arnie. Arnie was my editor. I was his news editor for the Academy News. Arnie was the editor-in-chief. He taught me how to write news. And later on, I became the editor of the commentator, the YU commentator, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. I want to continue this idea that Aaron said about the dichotomy in Dr. Belkin. Through my father was a friend of Dr. Belkin. They learned together in Radin. My father was later on a Olive Shalom. My father was a rabbi of a large shul in Detroit, and also one time was also the head of the Rabbonim in Detroit. And he took me to YU, it was with great pride, because he had some connections with YU, and he knew Dr. Belkin. I'll just give you an anecdote. When I walked down the corridor with my father on the way to be admitted to TA, I went there for the last 2 years, so we ran into Rav Gorelick. And Rav Gorelick said, Rav Yisrael! They knew each other also from Europe. Rav Yisrael, was tutst du da? What are you doing here? He says, I'm taking my son to teach, to learn here. He says, Oi, Rav Yisrael, never my rice from Dana. Take him out of here. Throw him out. He didn't want. He didn't want to see his...
his good friend's son learning in a Bikarshisher institution like YU. I can tell you Rabbi Ruchin Relic would be a lot better off, in my humble opinion today, if all his kids had gone to YU. But I don't want to elaborate. Let the person who will do the research around Rabbi Relic's life fill in the missing letters.
But later on, when I had to go to the university, it's expensive. My father didn't have a lot of income. It's the rabbinate, the Orthodox rabbinate. You talk about it. So we went into Reb Shmuel, to Rabbi Dr. Belkin, and he said, where are you from, Israel? He says, we're from Detroit. Oh, he said, let's put up your son for a scholarship from General Motors. And I got a scholarship for four years.
You have to explain, because you have people here from London, from the Ukraine. General Motors was located in Detroit. And they had to give money, you know, they robbed America blind, General Motors, so they had to give money back in a nice fashion, so they evidently gave scholarships. How Rabbi Belkin knew Detroit, General Motors, that's beyond me, but it shows you what...
It shows his interest, and for every year that I was at the college, I had we would meet for, you know, touch base. But that wasn't my main connection. My main connection was as the editor of the Commentator. This is a tumultuous year, 1960-61. It was a year of the blacks are trying to get free. We were picketing in front of Woolworths. We were so such gewaltige Eden that at that time we were friendly, by the way, with the... And it was a year when Dr. Belkin announced the expansion of Yeshiva College. Here's the Commentator I have for those who want to see segments of it. Here is his Yeshiva University to invest $30 million in new campuses. But that wasn't what made the connection. What made the connection was that we had a lot of chutzpah. I mean, that's, I think, I hope to this day that that's one of the elements of that Yeshiva College Reitz boys have. It's chutzpah.
I want to tell you, the Commentator was referred to by the administration as the common traitor. Got it? Commentator, common traitor.
So we called up the president of the council, the council of students, was a fellow named Benji Hirsch. I think he's a psychologist. We called up the ambassador. And we're 20 years old.
I remember this. Ben Jerich was from Brooklyn, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
A chubby kid.
Right, very big call up.
Gesunda.
We said, let's call up they claimed there was a lot of anti-Semitism at that time, in 1960-61 in Germany. It's coming back. It's not the Milky. It's not the Milky era.
Well, they don't know. You know what the Milky is, right? The Milky is now became, of course, celebre in Israel. Some kid went to Germany and Milky's, which is all the Israelis live on Milky's. I don't live in a Milky, it has too many calories. I live in a Dani, has a lot less calories. But it's an Israeli product, a fabulous product. The Milky, I still don't know whether it's a German version or they're talking about the Milky exported from here, is cheaper in Germany than it is here. So this kid put in an ad, we should all go to Germany, to Berlin. He's living in Berlin. So if you're listening to the radio or reading the Israeli papers, this issue is, of course, celebre at this moment in time. So that's what Larry's referring to.
At that time, so we called up the ambassador of Germany to the United States, and we said, listen, you want to prove that Germany is not anti-Semitic? We have a reporter. I didn't have a reporter. We have a reporter that's trained and speaks German. We want to send him to Germany to investigate. He says, fine. Well, that came out in the press. It was in the New York Times. And we found a fellow named Abe Siegelman, who was a product of the... had escaped from the Holocaust, German. And we finally sent him to write to 2 weeks in Germany. Abe Siegelman finds anti-Semitism still rampant in Germany. Sam Hartstein comes up to me and he says, Larry, now I'm Shibshon, but Larry, you know what this is doing? We're losing money. People aren't contributing. How can we send people at the expense of the German embassy to investigate anti-Semitism? It's cooked. People are angry. Dr. Belkin is angry. We were chutzpahnik. We continued. And I never heard from Dr. Belkin about this at all. I think that was his his trust and belief still in freedom of expression of the commentator. And it wasn't just that. The Yeshiva College at that time, I don't know if it exists today, it had such a dichotomy. You have, on the one hand, you have Rav Gorelick, who tells you, Nemtim arise from Danet, he's a Rosh Yeshiva. On the other hand, you have Litman, Alexander Litman, the professor of philosophy. I'm a chosid now. I'm a Lubavitcher chosid, and that's why one of the reasons I enjoy listening to you. You're one of the few misnagdim that talks well about the Lubavitcher.
That has an understanding and appreciation.
So, what was Dr. Littman's statement? He used to talk about the subgartelian regions. This was his... Or Fleischer. Fleischer said he stepped into something, a puddle of dog something, and he says it was carry coals to Newcastle. I mean, these kind of people... In the same building, under the same roof,
with the Rav.
He is the synthesizer, perhaps. But that this was also one of the gadlut of Dr. Belkin, that he was able to run an institution with crazy people like us, with rabbanim to one side, with professors on the other side, and keep them all under one roof. I think this is tremendous gadlus. And I think that this is something that has to be brought to his attention, and that's my presentation for this morning.
What Larry just referred to is a problem that we suffer from or live with until today. In other words, can we run an institution of higher education with academic freedom, or it has to be an institution where the academic freedom is limited? Or what the Rebbe used to call a Catholic college. And this is a point of debate until today. Without going into great detail, I've written about it, I've published about it, the second volume of the Rebbe has a lot of material on it, but you have a perfect example right here on this mountaintop. Next door is Machon Lev. Machon Lev, everything taught there is, there is nothing that criticizes Torah. There is no literature, it's not humanities, it's not liberal arts, it's essentially mathematics and science. They have a nursing school. Reb Shimshon Fuel Hirsch would be very happy with Machon Lev. Dr. Belkin and the Rav did not want yeshiva to function that way. The Rav stated time and again he is opposed to a Catholic college. The yeshiva is the yeshiva, and as he used to boast, no different than the Lashon. And the college has to be a university in the full sense of the American understanding. Now, I've often thought about this, and... I'll go back to a conversation I had with my second Rebbe when Yeshiva University, Reb Yosef Weiss, in 1953. Reb Yosef Weiss was a Torah Vadas boy. I think his background is Satmar from the other side. I think his parents and grandparents were Satmar Chassidim. And he was studying in Torah Vadas. And he left Torah Vadas. He came to Reitz. Because Reitz had Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, Torah Vadas had nobody on that level at that time. We're talking the 1930s. As you know, Reb Yosef Weiss should live and be well, and still teaching is a musmach of the yeshiva, 1940. Okay, make the cheshbon. It's almost 75 years since he got smicha. He is still teaching. Chaim Meiselman, who was in the Kollel last year, is studying Yeridaya with him this year. So Reb Yosef Weiss told me in 1953 about a conversation that he had with his Rebbe, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. It was about college. Reb Moshe said to him, Eben Gate, if we go to college, we have to do it properly already. And I think that that was the Rebbe's idea, that a college has to be a college. You have to expose a student. He's going to go out into the big world. He's going to be challenged endlessly by the big world. Let him feel the challenge already in college. Let him be prepared. Then you'll say, how can he handle this challenge? And that's where the Rav had the confidence that if you know how to learn and you know the halachic system and you have the foundation which the Rav felt elementary yeshiva and a high school have given you, a yeshiva high school, then you can handle a broad college. And I have to say, I have thought about this endlessly, and I can see both points of view. But on the other hand, the Rav's concept, fabulous. Why? And I'll bring it home to you black and white. Every few years in my time in yeshiva, the students would organize and they get angry. Why are we learning Greek mythology? Why are we required to learn Greek mythology? Those of you who have studied Greek mythology reads like some cheap novel or like some of the scandals that unfortunately some of our colleagues from all spectrums of the Torah world are involved with. Lo aleinu, lo aleinu. No, what, I have to know Greek mythology? So one year, this is in my time when I was a Rebbe already in the yeshiva, a group of students organized and got an appointment with the Rav. It may even be George Finkelstein may remember this. I think George got them the appointment with the Rav. And they come to the Rav and they say, Rabbi, you know, with great derech eretz, these kids come and these are kids, younger kids, and they're having a session with Mori Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, the enikel, the grandson of Rabbi Chaim Briska, and they tell the Rav their complaints, and the Rav says, what, you don't want to understand the Western world? The Rav says, this is the foundation of the Western world. If you don't understand Greek mythology, you can't understand the Romans, you can't understand the Reformation, you can't understand what happens in modernity and humanism, and all this goes back to Greek mythology. And if you want to know what the world is about, you have to know Greek mythology, and the Rav very nicely sent them away, and Greek mythology remained in the curriculum. So I want to tell you today, boy, do I understand why Greek mythology is so important. Look what is Greek mythology? The gods. The gods do good things, the gods do bad things. The bad things, every sin under the sun. They rob, they steal, they plunder, they rape, they seduce the gods, and they get away with it in Greek mythology. Now, look at the Western world. Take a look at the United States. Who our presidents have been. JFK, we worshiped the ground he walked in. I eulogized him. My eulogy was picked up by Jacqueline Kennedy. I have a personal letter from Jacqueline Kennedy thanking me because my eulogy was on the New Jersey radio. I wrote it out. It was published in the local newspapers. We worshiped the ground he walked in. Now we find out he had Secret Service letting him know when Jacqueline came home because he had play bunnies in the water with him. God have mercy. Bill Clinton was president of the United States. Jennifer sent him flowers every Friday. Do I have to elaborate? Monica Lewinsky, people compare her to Esther Hamalka, Hashem Yirachem Oleinu. This was the president of the United States. And we can go further and further on governors and politicians and leaders and people who get elected. But when you know Greek mythology, you understand it very well. I don't only have to talk about America. What about the state of Israel? We're going to have a president, a prime minister, and a chief rabbi cell to cell. No other country in the world can make such a boast. Kainain Hara. President, prime minister, chief rabbi. And, oh, if the gods can do it, why can't the simple people do it? And, wow, Greek mythology gives you the key to understand Western civilization. How did Chazal put it? Pnei hadar to pnei hakelef. That's exactly Greek mythology. So, Rebbe, I want to thank you for allowing me to study, and just what Larry said, we had teachers Fleischer would curse Dr. Belkin regularly, would maledict them. It was like he enjoyed putting a cuss word before Rav Shmuel Belkin's name. And that's it. He taught. They loved him. He was popular. Listman, I write about him in the, not Listman, Litman. Listman was a tzaddik, but Litman, I write about him in Revel, that rumor had it he came for a job in the yeshiva in the Depression. He had been a yeshiva bacher in his youth in Europe. And he came and he wanted to impress Rabbi Revel. He came with his tzitzis in dreisen, his tzitzis sticking out. Rabbi Revel saw he has tzitzit. Litman would get up in class, word by word, gentlemen, with the help of God, I'm going to prove that God doesn't exist. And he gave a whole lecture of apikorsis of atheism. It was unbelievable who this guy was. But he was a great lecturer. They loved him. He taught in yeshiva, chveis, till the day he retired or the day he died. I don't know which came first. So Larry's point, very fascinating. But Rabbi Belkin and Rabbi Revel, and above all for me, Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, felt that the university has to be a real university. It is not a Catholic college. Here in Israel, the debate rages on, and Machon Lev is your finest example of a university to be. They're heading, at one point they'll get university status, but it will be a Catholic university. It will be different than Bar Ilan. It will be different than Yeshiva U. Okay, Ellie, you wanted to ask something?
Do you think that that the Rav felt, or that you feel, it was necessary to challenge him? Meaning, one can have a quote-unquote non-Catholic college. There's enough out there to teach, to teach any course under the sun that a person wants to major in, without necessarily directly challenging.
That's why you would go to Lander College. At Lander College, every course, every teacher, every professor has to have approval of the rabbinic faculty, or at least the key members of the rabbinic faculty. So that's why you would go to Lander College. That's where Lander College is. Very different than Yeshiva U. But I want to tell you, I'll tell you a little story that greatly influenced my thinking as a machaneich and as a teacher and a rebbe. The story happened long before you were born. I don't want to mention a name because it's a very prominent Orthodox rabbinical family. I had this lady as a student. She was in college. She was Michlala, the foreign students division. And my wife knew her parents very well, knew the shul very well. My wife had grown up in that neighborhood, and we really bonded together. And this girl confided in me. She had tremendous religious problems. And I asked her, coming from a home like you came, where do you have all these questions? And this lady answered me, Rebbe, I came from a home, my mother was a Beis Yaakov product, everything was faith, you didn't ask questions. I went out on a date with this YU graduate, a student in medical school. And on that date, he threw questions at me. How do you know this? How do you know that? This part of the Torah is unfair. Mamzerut and what the guy picked upon. And the old scientific problems. And how old is the world? And this girl was shattered. No one had ever raised these questions before. And I have to tell you, she never ever was Mechallel Shabbos. She said to me, I will never hurt my parents. But you don't know what this girl went through. I played a big role in her life. I'll add to it just from the point of view of chinuch. She was interested in television. And her parents were mortified. And she was interested in newspapers. And she winds up in the Jerusalem Post doing it as a student, working there, getting some sort of fellowship there. And Rabbi Koopman is very upset. They're boys and girls, Jerusalem Post, right? They're boys and girls in the world. We have to learn how to get along with each other. And her father comes in, and I told her father, I said, if you force her to stop, you're going to break her, and you don't know what's going to happen to her. You have to give her your blessing, and tell her you have confidence in her. And I want to tell you, I went out on a limb. She didn't get married right away. She was involved in television. She was an anchor woman on some American television show, a news program. But the end of it was, Baruch Hashem, I won out. In her mid-30s, she got married, had children, remained frum, became a lot wiser, life, children, educate you. And I look back, I don't know, she would have been a lot better off had our father thrown 1,000 questions at her and discussed some of these topics. So it's Fielder's choice. I don't want to say kibluat dati, but for me personally, an open education was a lot better. And I have to compliment the Israeli system today, what's developed here in my world at least. I think I've told you, I have one grandchild, all my grandchildren have chosen different heads of the yeshiva. Everyone. And each one has been happy with what he chose. So now I have one in Yeruchim learning around the clock. He's a happy kid. I have one in, I believe it is Tekoa. It's a branch of Rabbi Steinsaltz. And this kid said to me, Sabu, he said, for the first time, I feel normal. I'm not viewed as being eccentric. I said, what do you mean? And he told me. He plays the saxophone. He's into movies. He makes movies. He plays the saxophone. I think he plays more instruments. He tells jokes. He's appeared on Israeli radio, on one of the Haredi stations, or semi, or whatever they call these stations, where they interviewed him. He tells jokes, and he plays the saxophone, and he sings. And he says, in this yeshiva, between 1 to 3, it turns into an orchestra. All the kids are musicians, 90% of the kids, and they're encouraged to practice. You understand how important that is? So you see, there's not one answer for everybody. Depends who you are. I don't want to say YU is better than Lander College or Lander College is better than YU, but if I have to go knowing what I know, and if I see a kid who has these tendencies, I would say go to Yeshiva University. I see a kid who's narrow and doesn't want anything beyond, all right, go to Lander College, but be aware, you're going to be asked questions later in life. You have to be able to handle it. Okay, thank you very much to Larry Shimshon Halperin, who worships two gods, the Rav and the Rebbe. And with this, I want to call attention, we lost a fabulous graduate of Yeshiva University this past Sukkot era, Norman Bernhardt, Rabbi Norman Bernhardt of Johannesburg. You don't know who that man was. We look back, he's a little older than I am, but we were contemporaries in the yeshiva. He always had tzidkut in him. And he too worshipped two gods, the Rav, and then he became a Lubavitcher. The Rebbe sent him to Johannesburg. It probably is the mid-60s, if I'm not wrong. He went to Johannesburg. The Rebbe sent him. People looked at each other. What happened to Normie Bernhardt? I think he went the name afterwards, Nachum Bernhardt, if I'm not mistaken. What happened to Normie? The Rebbe, South Africa, who goes to? There was apartheid then. Who goes to Johannesburg? And he revolutionized a good deal of South African Jewry. So I just want to recall his memory with awe. What an individual. Okay, let me go further. There's a world that we want to do about Rav Shmuel Belkin. Now, let me shift gears and let me talk about the Rav. Because you have to understand the Rav's personality and the Rav's view of himself to see how beautifully he complimented Rav Shmuel Belkin. And here, too, I quote to you from Vic Geller's volume, Orthodoxy Awakens. It's a very fascinating chapter on the Rav. Now, Vic Geller was in a unique position because Larry and I knew the Rav and knew Dr. Belkin, but we were kids looking at great people. Vic Geller worked with them, worked with the yeshiva. Vic Geller today, and he's not in the best of health, should have a refuah shleima, lives a few blocks from here, is well into his 90s today. And Vic headed up the community service division, which would be akin to what Kenny Brander developed with this, with the Center for the Jewish Future. What Rabbi Brander developed, the CJF, Center for the Jewish Future, would be akin to the position that Vic Geller held when we were growing up. So he already was a mature individual. He graduated high school before World War II. We served in World War II. We went to college after World War II. It was delayed. The American government paid for his college education as a returning veteran who saw battle in France, etc. And Vic knew them, I don't want to say as an equal, but as a mature individual. And Vic Geller is very insightful. So I want you to hear what he has to say about the Rav. Now, first of all, he comes up with a very interesting document. And this document is very important. I actually believe I gave the document to Vic, but I knew about this document too. It's out of the mid-1930s, 1936, and the correspondence goes back 1937. When the Rav comes to America, Rav Moshe is the Rosh Yeshiva in YU, Rabbi Belkin is the president, logically speaking, rationally speaking, halavai, the Rav would have gone to yeshiva, joining the faculty. But there were two problems. One is the yeshiva was very small. You had Rav Moshe, what are you going to do with the Rav? He was the youngster of the Rav. Number two, nepotism. The greatness of Yeshiva University is that it is not a family-owned institution. It's not Mir, it's not Chevron, it's not Lakewood, it is a public trust. Chaim Berlin had a bitter battle over this when Rav Huttner, at the end of Rav Huttner's career there, whether it's a public trust or owned by an individual, and the public trust concept won out. But this is a big problem with Yeshivat. To be a Rosh Yeshiva in Hebron, to be a Rosh Yeshiva in Telz, you have to be part of the family. To teach in YU, even a dummy like Aaron Rakefet can teach if he just has what to give. And this, we have to salute YU. It's not like Telz in Cleveland, where you, if you visited Wycliffe, a tremendous campus stands empty, because they did not have good faculty after Reb Mordechai Gifter took ill, and there was no one to succeed. They didn't bring in outsiders. Telz in Chicago and Telz in Riverdale is infinitely more today than Telz in Cleveland, the original Telz. The branches conquered the homeland. So, you don't want nepotism. No, the Rav, there was no talk of bringing the Rav to YU. He winds up in Boston. But nevertheless, the Rav had certain abilities that the students in Reed's 1930s students, not the students of today. Today, most of the students couldn't care less about philosophy and interaction with the Western world. How many students come and hear the Rav's Talmidim, who yet deal with these problems, teach? Their students today, more or less, are not interested. If a Talmud of the Rav would give a lecture on Tanya, he'd get a much bigger crowd than if a Talmud of the Rav would give a lecture on Reb Shintrafol Hirsch and interaction with general culture. But that's the reality. That's fine. Life is like this. We go in cycles. So the students were clamoring, here's the Rav in Boston. Here's the Rav who has a PhD from the University of Berlin. Here's the Rav who Reb Moshe says about him in class. And I heard this from Reb Moshe's students. I heard this from Rabbi Mendel Lewittis. This is first graduating class, Yeshiva College, 1932, studies with Reb Moshe. And Reb Moshe would say, I don't understand this sugya entirely. I have to ask my son. I have to ask my son. My son to go. My son to go. So the students were clamoring, we want to hear a little bit from the Rav. So they brought the Rav in to give a series of philosophic lectures at the yeshiva. And the Rav does not get paid. And he writes a letter Yeah, it's the Rav stationery. It's very important when you see the stationery. The letter is not false. It is accurate. And you know, in the world of Torah scholarship today, lo aleinu, we have certain publishers that are very well known that will publish falseness when it comes to history of Torah. There's the Rav's letter. Dear Dr. Revel, I want to remind you that the sum of $125 is long due to me. And I would appreciate your remitting the sum as soon as possible, as I am in need of it. Expecting to hear from you very soon. I am very truly yours, Joseph Soloveitchik. Dean Isaacs answers the letter, then called assistant to the president, Moses Isaacs, and he tells him, don't have money, difficult times, current situation. We're going to pay you $5 per month beginning with January 1st and running through July 1st, 1939. And Vic Yella comments, the timeline of this matter underscores the desperate financial conditions that prevailed at the yeshiva. The Rav waited patiently for 2 years before writing this letter. It then took Yeshiva 19 months to reply. After all that delay, they agreed to pay him only $30.24 on the dollar. Tell me, why is this so important? Vic Yella doesn't realize how important this letter is. Or at least he doesn't articulate it. But yours truly will. Gentlemen, the Rav constantly prays Dr. Belkin from the day he became president. All salaries in the yeshiva were paid on time. The Rav, read about it. In the second volume, The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Read about it. Word by word, the author translates the Rav into English from Yiddish. And you hear the Rav saying, Taira Vadas, Chaim Berlin, the yeshivas in Brooklyn, criticize us. Check if our tzitzit are good. You know, the old story, the used to pat a student on the shoulder, run your hand down to see if he's wearing tzitzit. Rabbi Revel was famous for that. Who is I, Yiret Shemayim? He called the tzitzit Yiret Shemayim, which he's correct. It's to remember all the mitzvot. The Rav went crazy against the other yeshiva. When were their salaries paid in time? Vic Snow asked your uncle how many times he was paid on time by Chaim Berlin in the 30s, into the 40s, into the 50s. Check with today. We have multi-millionaires in the Torah world. It's a different world today. Some of the money is ill-gained. That's a different story. But to God have mercy, how many people are in jail? What's happening now in Belgium? The Rosh Yeshiva arrested in Yerushalayim. Here there's a gag order. They didn't release names. But in Belgium, it's front page news. Jews with long beards in jail over sukkahs in jail right now. Unbelievable. Laundering money, drug money. It's a different world today. In YU, Reb Shmuel Belkin, from the day the Reb said he became president, he was Maisa Nefesh, that salary should be paid on time. You can understand the Rav's appreciation. Gentlemen, I said last night, if the OU had its way, they would give me a few thousand books, author's discount. Here, Akefet, send them over to Israel and sell them on Rehov Ben Yehuda. I'm not going to sell books. I don't touch money. I have my own principles. Save it. But thank God today I have enough income coming in. I can have bread and water the rest of my life. Baruch Hashem. But I know what it is not to have money for food. I lived here after I came in Aliyah 69. I remember what went on after the Yom Kippur War. I remember well. And I had 2 full-time jobs. I remember well the whole economy was black. I'm paying taxes. The checks government, Jewish agency, etc., etc., you don't forget what it means to be limited financially. The Rav didn't forget. And he was always Makir Taiva to Reb Shmuel Dalkin. Okay, that's one important point, and that's basic to understanding their relationship. Then the Vic Geller goes on, he describes the Rav's schedule. I told you he flew in every Tuesday morning on the shuttle. There was a shuttle. It doesn't exist today. You know what the shuttle was? You didn't have to reserve in advance. You went to the airport. There was a shuttle, Boston to New York, Philadelphia to New York, vice versa. The plane filled up. The plane took off. It was fabulous. It's not like today. You have to reserve. Yeah, I remember it going onto a plane where you just walked onto the plane. They didn't even check if you had a passport or better. You just walked onto the plane, but the Arabs changed the whole world. Maybe the Secretary of State would wake up one day and understand it. Wow. Now he describes very, very beautiful description. But those are facts that we all know already. And he describes Rav Soloveitchik. Let me just quote one sentence here. For 44 years, Rav Soloveitchik lit up the skies of Reeds like a surging comet, trailed by a long retinue of young men illuminated by his singular brilliance. Trail of young men? Here. The Rav would walk from the yeshiva to the subway. Those of you who know Washington Heights, the 7th Avenue, the 8th Avenue, either subway, the 7th Avenue, two blocks up, three blocks if you turn left, the 8th Avenue, Big Hill, five blocks, six blocks. You never saw the Rav walk alone, always surrounded by Talmidim, badgering him with questions, not just in Halacha. I remember talking with the Rav, it had to be 56, about Adlai Stevenson and General Eisenhower. I remember talking with the Rav on the way to the subway, and I remember the Rav saying, if we could only elect Adlai Stevenson, he's a pleasure to speak to. You hear him, the man has intellect, the man has depth, but nothing will help. General Eisenhower is like the cowboys and Indians. He's a popular hero, quote, end quote. Now you think about that. A complex man. Rabbi Soloveitchik's life was an arena in which a radiant intellect and a sensitive soul challenged, supplemented, and competed with each other. And that's absolutely, that's the Rav. Brisk, kulo brisk. And yet when he gave a drasha, he revealed his heart. You could cry, you could laugh. The most intimate moments of his life with his wife, with his parents, with his children became examples of Torah Hashem. He would bring it home. But with this all, it's a very important point. The Rav was a humble, quiet individual running away from the limelight. You see, had the Rav sought the limelight, he could have been competition for Rabbi Belkin. But the Rav was very happy just to be himself, just to learn away from the limelight. His goals in life changed. A person shifts his values. A young man wants to be the biggest rabbi in the world. When I got smicha from the yeshiva, my goal was to see, Jason, that there wasn't a Mechallel Shabbos left in the United States. 60 years later, my goal is that Rakefet should continue learning and be Mechadesh, a little Torah and Machshava. Follow? Totally different. The Rav, one story I'm an ear witness to. Jerry Blau is one of the earliest people, Harab Yosef Blau, we know him as Jerry. Jerry Blau is one of the earliest graduates to go to study. I think he went to KBY. You can correct me, Larry, if I'm wrong, but I believe it was KBY was the only game in town. He picked up the Israeli attitude comes back to America, and he's talking to the Rav, and it's after a shir, and he says to the Rav said. And Rebbe jumps in him, which Rav? What rabbi are you talking about? And he says, Rebbe, I mean you, so say you. Don't give me that Rav, third person. The Rav. They wrote about him in the Israeli press when he was world famous in the 70s, that someone knocked on his door and the Rav himself answered the door. You understand? Could be for Hasidic Rebbe, for Chveis Rosh Hashiva with Gaiver and Kavod, to answer the door, to answer the telephone. The Rav stationery. You saw the stationery. I have many copies of the Rav stationery. All the personal letters. Joseph Soloveitchik. No titles. And I want to give you a bracha. When you're young, you need titles. I understand. You're going into the rabbinate. But when you reach 40 and you still need titles, you are in trouble. Take my word, Fred. Moshe, you see the Rav. And Vic Yella tells an amazing story. And this captures the Rav's image. But it explains to you how he could totally supplement and complement Rabbi Belkin, and there was no conflict between them. For the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, absolutely no conflict. We'll come to the conflict, and you'll hear Rakefet's vart that if the Rebbetzin had been alive, there would have been no conflict in the 70s either. But by then, the Rebbe was under the influence of his students. There was no Rebbetzin around to slap him his face and to slap the students away. But the students, they caused conflict. But until then, there was no conflict whatsoever. The public exercise of power had little appeal for the Rav. Political posturing and confrontation were contrary to his nature. And here on page 257, Vic Geller tells a beautiful story that the head of the Israeli bonds in the United States, the national chairman, lived in Boston. And in the late 50s, he visits Israel. He comes back from Israel, and he contacts his local rabbi, and he says to his rabbi, I looked like a fool in Israel. Here I am, national chairman of Israel Bonds, such an important American citizen. And wherever I went, people heard I was from Boston, and the first question they asked me, do you know Rabbi Soloveitchik? And I had to answer, no, I never heard of him. And this is a guy from Boston. I imagine he prayed in a conservative temple. I can't imagine in an Orthodox shul. But he didn't know who Rabbi Soloveitchik was. He said the prime minister, the president, everyone he dealt with, the heads of the Jewish agency, everyone had one question for him. Do you know? Remember, at that time, they were gearing up for the chief rabbinate election. Rabbi Soloveitchik already had become a known object in Israel. Who is this Rabbi Soloveitchik? Whenever I went, wherever I went in Israel, when people heard that I was from Boston, they wouldn't stop telling me what a great man he was. But you see, this was the Rav's personality. So that's another aspect that gives you insight to why they had such an amicable relationship. You actually had Shnei Malachim. You had two kings, and Chazal say you can't have two kings, but here each one had his own dominion. Dabar ledar, v'yein shnei dabarim ledar. That's the Chazal. So you can check me out, Yomo. You're a working encyclopedia, but I think I have it right. Let me go one step further, and we'll finish up for today. A lot more has to be done, but this is something I spoke about. Not only that. You see, whenever a tremendous halachic issue came up, Rabbi Belkin could stand on the sidelines. He didn't have to get involved with the machloket. The Rav already could not stand on the sidelines. He was the Rav already. His Talmidim, the rabbinical council, his Talmidim took over the rabbinical council. They made the Rav chairman of the Halachic Commission. The Rav now is a focal figure, and he has the paskin. He can't run away. He's the Rav. the buck ends here. He has to give answers. So you have the Cuba question. And that was a question that shook the Orthodox community. Remember when I told you, I believe it was this year we spoke about it, I know I spoke about it in the past, and Mayor Weingarten corresponded with me on it, where the Fidel Castro is willing to let the Jews out, and the day, or it's Batista during the most of the reign of Batista's dictator of Cuba, the Jews were at home, and now things began to change, his attitude towards the Jews began to change, and Jews were anxious to get out. And he allowed a flight to leave on Yom Kippur. To allow the Jews out. Who did they turn to? The heads of the Mizrahi, he gives the names there. I knew these people, David Weingarten, who was on the Jewish agency staff, Rabbi Israel Friedman, from the Mizrahi, the Jewish agency, they contacted the Rav. And as I told you, maybe it was last year, no one knew why the Rav didn't respond immediately. He told Rabbi Weingarten, he told David Weingarten, I'll call you back in a few hours. Give me a few hours to give you an answer. And years later, David Weingarten met the Rav at a wedding, and he said, the Rav recognized him. Oh, yeah, you called me with that Shaila, what was it, 15 years ago? And David said, Rebbe, may I ask you a question? Why did you tell me you'll call me back in 2 hours? Why didn't you answer right away? And the Rav told him he wanted to consult with Reb Aaron Cutler. And he wanted to be sure he would reach Reb Aaron and present the question to Reb Aaron. And both of them ruled, get the Jews out on Yom Kippur. Now, my version of the story that I heard, that Batista backed down, and he evidently people told him, Yom Kippur, you know, even the Goyim know, and he allowed the plane to leave a day later. But you see, the Rav is the one they turn to. The end of the 50s, 1957, I lived this, there was a bill in the United States Senate to outlaw the way they shackle and slaughter the animals, Tzav Bal Chayim, humane society of slaughter, humane slaughter, what a slaughter society, and it had tremendous backing. When you read the Silver Era, which was not available last night, and the only way you can get it in Israel, because no one's interested in selling books today, they get their money up front. Let the author go fly a kite, let Rabbi Silver go fly a kite, then there's no L'shem Shemayim outside of Art Scroll. Art Scroll has a purpose in life. It's endowed, they raise funds, they want to educate, whatever, they want to teach, etc., etc. So the only way you can get the Silver Era is going to the websites of the OU, of what's the other one that sells books? Amazon, or it could be their other websites, see where it's cheaper, and that's the way you can get silver. So I write about it in the Silver Era, they developed a holding pen where there was no Tzav Bal Chayim. The animal, if I recall correctly, instead of hoisting the animal was placed down, and it involved a lot less Tzav Bal Chayim. And the Rav and Reb Leizer Silver went to the slaughterhouses, other Rabbanim went, and they approved it. But they wanted Reb Aaron Cutler to join too. And the Rav spoke with Reb Aaron. Reb Aaron would say he would check it, he'd go along, he's not a practicing rabbi, once looked through the halachat again. And then a RCA rabbi heard that Reb Aaron will not sign, and if Reb Aaron doesn't sign on, you're going to have a big problem with the Haredi world, which was becoming more powerful in the United States. And the Rav called Reb Aaron. I know one rabbi who was with the Rav in his home in Boston, and he repeated the whole conversation to me. And the Rav said to Reb Aaron, Chaz, the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva, Vetnish Kasmanin, that the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva doesn't want to sign. And Reb Aaron hummed and hawed, and the Rav said, I want the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva to know he has to sign, and if he doesn't sign, I will refute his arguments in public, and you know that I am halachically correct. And Rav Aaron said, well, if you feel that way, I'll have to sign. And Rav Aaron signed, and the Congress adopted the law permitting the new method of shackling the animal before slaughter. So once again, you see a critical issue came up. Rav Shmuel Belkin is not involved. He doesn't have to get caught in the crossfire. The rub is there. He draws the fire. And he gives the decision. And I'll show you next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, time and again, how the Rav is able to complement and supplement Reb Shmuel Belkin. He goes about his work, and the Rav is there, the, I would say, the lodestone, the guiding star of the yeshiva, and there is no jealousy, no controversy. It is a very amicable relationship. The late 40s, 50s, 60s, 100%. The biggest machloket of all, where Rabbi Belkin is drawn in, we will see next week, it's the Rav who literally saves him, pulls him out of the water, resuscitates him, and until today, the Rav's image flows over Rav Shmuel Belkin on that issue, and there's that mutual, fabulous relationship. So to summarize on this Monday morning, when we want to wish the Tarragons a safe and wonderful trip exploring the world, and we'll be happy to hear your report when you get back. Do me one favor, don't climb any mountains. V'day lechakim, Shem Yerachem. What did we do today? We had a special guest, jurisprudence doctorate, Larry Shimshon Halperin. Interesting individual. Detroit, Litvish, Lubavitcher Chassid today. What about your children? Where are they?
Some went to Oman.
So they were together with my grandson, Kanain Hara, but there were 30,000 people there.
We have a bit of everything. The YU structure.
No, so Norman Bernhardt also. Not all his kids are Lubavitch. He has some in Vedaniel. He has all over the world. Some are total Lubavitches. Some are more mainstream YU type. Fascinating. Okay, Baruch Hashem. So what do we do today? We also announced the new name, Hakatan. Hakatan. Do you know why Rafi said Hakatan? He says, why should it have been any different than Reb Menashe Klein, who always signs his name, Menashe Hakatan? I like that answer. I thought about it later, and I slapped Rakefet down. I don't like turning you into a big shot. Grois. You follow? You're going to son Rafi Hagadol? No, Rafi Hakatan. Beautiful. We heard from Larry about the Reb Shmuel Belkin, about the man, about Detroit, about the Reb Yeruchim Gurelik, a little bit insight into the yeshiva of our days. Coming back to what I had to say, we analyzed that letter from the Rav. You see, you can just look at the letter and say, "Ay vey, look how poor they were." But you think what I told you, how he stood in awe of Reb Shmuel Belkin, that the man was meisa nefesh, his health, his family, but everyone working for YU had to be paid on time. That's an important document. Secondly, the fact that the Rav, he ran away from the limelight. I mean, it's hard to conceive the most famous Rosh Yeshiva in the world, perhaps the most famous rabbi in the world, the most famous Lamdin in the world, the most famous Jewish philosopher in the world, at least I hear over here in Israel, everyone, my wife said to me, will you teach me where the Rav talks about the two creations, Adam 1, Adam 2, the lonely man of faith. Everyone knows him as a philosopher here, because the writings on Shas and Paiskim are much more esoteric. You got to be a Lamdan to understand them. But he ran away from the limelight. There was never a competition, there was never controversy, never jealousy between him and Rav Shmuel Belkin. One was the president, and one was the Rav. And each one understood their role. And of course, as the Rav, he took the heat off Dr. Belkin. Every major question that came along, willy-nilly, to use a word the Rav taught me, the Rav had to respond to, not the Shmuel Belkin. Gentlemen, I have a lot of freebies. Just bear with me. Yitzchak is not here. This is by Harab Eli Carrigan. Pass this to Morty Carrigan, please. If anyone wants Lichbenching for the year from the Moetzah Datin of Yerushalayim, two more copies. If anyone here is a disciple of Rabbi Ovadia, Ovadia Yosef, here's a beautiful booklet put out in the Haredi world on his first yahrzeit with everything the new generation goes for, pictures of Gedolei Yisrael, and interesting material. You're welcome to it. This is a book put out trying to reach out to Jews running a Shabbos Yisraelit, a Shabbos where Chiloniim and Datiyim come together. This is imitating American outreach. We Americans have greatly influenced the world of Israel, and I apologize to you. What you didn't know was I had in my notes last night a whole discourse on that aspect, but it would have taken me another hour, and you can't bore an audience beyond. I spoke for an hour and 20 minutes, so I had to, you understand, but you didn't know I was missing. That's the secret the Rav taught me. You have to end and end in a way that no one should think you left something out. Anyone who's in the teaching world, this is Midei Chodesh B'Chodesho, my Talmud edits it. This is Elul Tishrei, fabulous material with children in Israel. Anyone interested, this is put out by the European Rabbinate. It's the issue dedicated to the memory of Rabbi Rose, who was the Menachel Kalev, the European Rabbinate, for I think onto 50 years or something. I knew him, a wonderful Jew. Anyone interested, Maseh El Ha'achva, this is published, Can We Pull Together Jews Who Are Religious and Irreligious? Many different articles, people from our world, basically. Fascinating, but you have to be able to read modern Hebrew. This is another publication in modern Hebrew, Kivonim Chadashim, how we can go in new paths, develop new paths in the modern world, deals with a lot of what we spoke about in class, the conflict between Torah and between Western civilization. Furthermore, Mifsa Balashin, I call to your attention the former head of the Mossad, Ephraim Halevi, who is an Englishman, born and bred in England. The former head of the Mossad was in Bnei Akiva. I don't know how frum he was afterwards. I know he didn't wear a kippah, but you could be frum and not wear a kippah if you're of Yekker origins. He is an great-grandson of the Netziv of Volozhin, and he's gone back to Volozhin with tremendous plans to rebuild the Volozhin yeshiva and what he wants to do in Volozhin. Anyone who's interested, you're welcome to take it. And here is a wonderful article on Yahadut HaGirsah HaTel Avivit, where they're trying to do outreach. Three big shuls in Tel Aviv have been resuscitated. And I marked off in the article, one of the rabbis is my very student from this kollel, Harav Ariel Constantine. He is doing wonders. The picture speaks for itself. One person, two sides of him. Baruch Hashem. Gentlemen, Sunday we're back to Rav Menashe Klein. Only come to class if you can tolerate terror. It is the only document I know of which actually delineates and documents the terror that entered the New York scene with the machlokes between the Tomchei Rav Feinstein and the people in Brooklyn. It is a sad class on Sunday, but I have to be honest, this is part of Torah history as well. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya, and once again a thank you to Larry Halpern. Okay, any questions? Any gentlemen? You have a class shortly, so let me not... There's a system here. Oh, hola? Yeah, that picture hangs upstairs, a similar picture. It hangs upstairs, yeah.
Shalom Aleichem Rebbe. Dean Lutran from Johannesburg.
Oh my gosh. So, you know what I was saying.
I know what you were saying. And interestingly, my mother-in-law is a palliative care doctor, and she looked after my Bernard in the last few months. And they made such a nice at his levaya in the eulogy, thanking her for the care that she gave. So it was fantastic. I listened. I've been listening to Shirim for about 5-6 years, so I've come to learn a good for a week.
Very nice.
So I thought I'd come listen to you.
Very nice.
The other interesting thing, you know, the Shabbos project of our chief rabbi.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So they've done a lot of the marketing here in English. So it's not seen as an Israeli thing.
Yeah, they've picked it up from what happened in South Africa, no question about it. And what happened, I spoke about South Africa last night, actually, in my talk. The percentage of Shmirat Shabbat, the Balei Tshuva, Baruch Hashem.
Wonderful, thank you very much.
It is great.
Thank you, Rav. Thank you.
Tell me, Zar, is he still in the main shul? Is he okay? A nephew, he's a nephew of Shmuel Zar. S-A-R.
S-A-R, not Z-A-R.
Could be Z-A-R. That's
there is a Zar that I know who I see from time to time.
How old is he?
He's a few years older than me. Must be in his early 40s.
Must be your grandson. Okay. There's a Zar family. Part went to America, part went to South Africa. Oh.
Shakar, be in touch. I listen to you. It's okay.
I apologize, Rebbe, for my tardiness.
Why are you getting so late? What is going on?
Yeah, I had to drop my son off at Gan.
That's a good excuse. I can't argue with it. You win. But listen to the first part of this.
Yeah, I have to.
I'm building bricks here.
I understand.
You understand that letter from the Rav about the money?
Sure.
You understand what I did with it?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a,
I challenge anyone to tell me I'm wrong.
There's a... They say that Rich Israel, when he took over, one of the first things he did was increase the salaries of the Rosh Yeshiva. Because the complaint was that Rosh Yeshiva are around, they're not making enough money, so they have to go and they have shuls and they have responsibilities. The first thing he did was, you know, increase their salary, I think, a lot. And then he built them offices and the new center and whatnot.
Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem.
So
are they around more?
I think a lot of them, I really do think that there's a large percentage of the Rosh Yeshiva there. I don't think people are necessarily interested in, like, really speaking to them. Meaning, Rav Shulman learns morning Seder in the Beis Medrash all morning, but I never see anybody necessarily go up and, like, speak to him. Rav Shechter's there all day. Rav Solovsky is there. People go up to Rav Shechter.
People don't want to disrupt his learning.
Okay, but say Rav Shechter's there all day. Rav Solovsky's there a lot.
So Belovsky.
Twersky's there. He's hard to find, but he's there. He's in. I mean, whatever. He's
in the real base.
He's what?
He's in the real base.
Rosolovsky's there. Twersky's there.
How do you pronounce his name? It's Sobolovsky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sobolovsky.
Sobolovsky.
Do you know who his uncle lives? Was?
Uncle? No.
Yes.
Chaim Potok.
Really?
That's correct.
That's very interesting. Rav Neuberger's around a lot of such as. I mean,
no, his son.
What?
His mother is Chaim's young. We grew up in the Bronx together. His mother, there were three children. Chaim, Simon, who was my classmate, Zichrono Levracha, and then the daughter. The daughter was a lot younger. That's his mother.
He talks about his grandfather's store in the Bronx.
Right. I write about it in Washington.
And Tuvia Sharfman, of course. Rabbi Tuvia Sharfman.
Tuvia Sharfman is the Rav.
Right, right.
That two people scared the hell out of Chaim, Yeruchim Gerelik and the Rav, and that's why he winds up in the seminary.
Yeah.
But I was a different seminary than what happened with the seminary. Interestingly, Simon also went to the seminary after Yeshiva College. He died young, was a conservative rabbi. All his four kids are totally frum. So it's interesting, but not Chaim. Probably has to do with the mother. That Simon was married to a woman who was innately more frum. Probably has to do with the mother. It's a world gone by, but that's life. We are building a new world today, as I said last night.
Sheikh Rabbi. Anyways, yes, I do think most of the Rashiva are actually around. I don't know if people are necessarily...
Well, the greatness of Israel is in all these schools, no one has two jobs. They're locked in more or less. You follow me? BMT worked that way. I'm talking to Rebbeim in the morning. No one ran around. Kids could approach them. I imagine in Torah Shraka, kids can approach them. In Gris, certainly, kids can approach their Rebbeim. It's Baruch Hashem. Everyone is grounded. My problem, your problem is that when I'm here, you're not awake. When you're awake, I'm running further. But Baruch Hashem.
They're more invested. Meaning the yeshiva that you teach in, or the institution that you teach in here, at least for a lot of the Rebbeim, at least, I see it becomes your life. Meaning it's not like something which is separate, and then you're not a lecturer or a professor that you come to give your lecture.
I always tell people I live in Gris. I don't teach in Gris. But I'm the only one here. I'm here Friday. I'm here Cholamayid. That's a different story. I'm a different individual. I'm unique in that respect for many reasons. But what I found in YU in May was that the institution is too big. I may be wrong, but I got the feeling no one knows what's going on with it. I can give you a simple example. They shipped the books over here for Revel. No one knows whose books, what books, when books. They think I own the books. I said, I don't own the books. Bernard Revel Gradual owns the books, but Bernard Revel Gradual couldn't care less. They shipped them here. So I said, now you own the books. I told that to Sherry yesterday. She called me and said, question with the OU. I said, whatever you and Stephanie decide, I go with it. I'm a team player. You make your decision. But it's a problem with the... Here, I see the way they advertise. Here, they give you available at your local Judaica store or visit, and then they tell you how to get it, you see? So I see already, it's a new world today. Barnes & Noble went out of business. So you understand why.
Yeah.
Why should you go and waste your time? You know the book. You get the book. The Gemanu. My neighbor Sam Dershowitz tells me he bought books for 1 penny a piece. He said the shipment cost $4. But it turned out he paid $4.01. Okay? No, a book for 1 penny? I don't know. Baruch Hashem. I hope they're not selling my books for 1 penny. Guys, thank you for
having me. I just wanted to let you know that I'll not be here the next 2 Mondays. I'm going to America.
What's up in America? That's a good reason.
Yeah, family simcha. And,
what's pshat of family simcha?
What's pshat?
Yeah, what?
Oh, it's a bar mitzvah. And, the next day, my grandfather's unveiling. So I'm trying to put them together. So I just wanted to let you know that I won't be here. But not because I want to be here.
Appreciate your good words. And just don't climb mountains, whatever you do.
I won't.
I mean, what we go through.